am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Holy One, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. Amen. Please be seated. We are midway through our Lenten journey. And looking back on our Hebrew Bible readings for the past three Sundays, we can see that it's been all about the covenants. Those sacred agreements and bonds between God and those that God has created. All about the covenants. On the first Sunday in Lent, we heard the story of God's covenant spoken to Noah, a promise to every living creature signified by a rainbow that God would never again destroy the earth by flood. And then on the second Sunday, last week, we heard about God's covenant signified by a change of names with Abram and Sarai, hereafter known as Abraham and Sarah, that they would become the ancestors of many nations. And today we have the covenant, later signified by stone tablets, that articulates the practices and expectations that would distinguish the Jewish people as those whose cries God had heard and had liberated from slavery. All three of these covenants, with their individual signs, the rainbow, the name changes, the stone tablets, all three of these covenants are actually signs in themselves. They are signs of caring relationship between God and God's children. They are signs of who and whose we are. Now, the covenant that we hear of today is, of course, known as the Ten Commandments. The word Torah, which describes the first five books of the Bible, is commonly and not entirely accurately translated as law, which is why we talk about Ten Commandments, thou shalt not. And these Ten Commandments, of course, are central to Torah. But author Barbara Brown Taylor observes that a more accurate translation of Torah might be instruction or teaching. So if we think of the covenant with Israel as teachings rather than commandments, then we see that the ten teachings are not so much a set of rules and obligations as they are a statement about God, by God, about who God is, and what a relationship between God and those whom God has liberated should look like. Taylor writes, Torah is given to the people as divine direction. It describes the practices of those in covenant with the faithful God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jesus. This is really important. It's a really important point, and it's worthy of a slight digression here, because people so often look at today's gospel lesson about Jesus in the temple at Passover as being about Jesus separating himself from Judaism as he turned over the tables, when actually this episode depicts Jesus' messiahship as rooted in and the fulfillment of the Jewish tradition and the covenant that is its foundation, the covenant that we are focusing on today. Now, if you're interested in a fuller treatment of this passage from John's Gospel, you can go to our website, and you can follow the link on that website to my sermon that I did in 2021 on this passage. So, returning to the Ten Teachings, how do we, as inheritors of this tradition through the faith of Jesus, how do we respond? What is the relationship between the people's obedience and God's faithfulness? Actually, Since the covenants with Noah and Abraham and Sarah took place well before the covenant with Moses, we see that God's faithfulness was well established long before the Exodus. So the point of the Ten Teachings then was and is to guide the people in the practices that would ultimately be life-giving for them as individuals and as the people of God. As Taylor says, those who ignore the divine teachings do so at their peril, not because God is standing over them with a hammer, but because the teachings describe the way of life. To ignore them is to wander into the ways of death instead, where God's faithfulness can be of little use. The teachings are about life, abundant life, life of trust in the goodness of God, as opposed to the tyranny of anxiety and self-centeredness. And as Jesus pointed out during his ministry, it all comes down to two things: love of God and love of neighbor. Love of God and love of one's neighbor. But just because it's that simple doesn't mean it's that easy. The teachings are crystal clear until real life intervenes. And nowhere is this more evident than in teaching number 4. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. We talk a good game about Sabbath and how important it is, but we are lousy about following this teaching. We always have a good reason for not taking God up on God's offer of rest and refreshment. What's a little chore here? Coaching a soccer game there? One more social media check-in, right? Taylor writes of folks in the rural South near where she lives who put out yard signs with images of the tablets, Moses' tablets, and they carefully mow around them on a Sunday afternoon. In his book, Sabbath as Resistance, Walter Brueggemann points out that the importance and particular significance of the teaching on Sabbath derives from the contrast between the God of liberation and the Pharaoh of commodification, relentless acquisition, and exploitation. God makes clear that Sabbath rest is a counterpoint to slavery, which was a constant routine of work and production, devoid of rest. Sabbath is a statement that commodification, relentless acquisition, and exploitation are characteristics of Pharaoh and the antithesis of God's dream for creation. And it is in this way that Sabbath rest, is an act of resistance to the Pharaoh of this age. And then Brueggemann goes a little further. He notes that the Sabbath is an alternative to the commercial noise that makes demands on our time, the need to be on the go, filling every spare minute with activities for ourselves and our children to the point that our rest time isn't rest at all. We have become restless. Sabbath observance, by contrast, is an acknowledgement that our lives and all that we have are gifts from God, and that we are called to gladly let go of our need to be controlled by achievement culture. The Christian household has done a pretty poor job of articulating Sabbath as gift, opting instead to portray it as an obligation. When I was growing up in Virginia, we had what were called blue laws, and I understand they're also in Massachusetts, but this is my experience. We had these blue laws, so-called because they were printed on blue paper, and they mandated Sunday closings of commercial establishments, particularly liquor stores. The religious community that influenced this legislation was far more concerned about controlling people's behavior than they were about gratitude for God's abundance. In our Lent book group study of Barbara Brown Taylor's Holy Envy, we've learned that the title comes from one of theologian Christer Stendahl's criteria. There were three of them, but this is one of his criteria for interfaith understanding. He says that we should leave room for holy envy. To feel holy envy is to view a belief or a practice of another faith group as something that illuminates and enlivens our own faith. It's a kind of an envy that is not a matter of judgment or comparison. It's an envy that comes from curiosity and humility, holy envy. I have holy envy. I have holy envy of the Jewish tradition of welcoming the Sabbath as a bride, welcoming her divine peace and wisdom into the community on Shabbat. The congregation faces the sunset and sings, "Let's go, my beloved, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the presence of Shabbat." I will not offend you by trying the Hebrew or by singing it, but there is a YouTube video that I've linked on the website, and I hope you'll listen. It is delightful. It is addictive. It is wonderful. It is all about welcoming the bride of Sabbath. Imagine how this different perspective could open us up, joyfully greeting the Sabbath bride, contrasted with the dour cry of "close the liquor stores." How might this change our perspective? From obligation, this change of perspective from obligation to desire, transform us. It's a heavy lift, I know. Our culture is so totally interwoven with Sabbath busyness that unraveling it seems impossible. But perhaps we're closer than we think. Brueggemann writes, "I have come to think that the moment of giving the bread of Eucharist as gift is the quintessential center of the notion of Sabbath rest in Christian tradition. It is gift we receive in gratitude. Imagine having a sacrament named thanks. Jesus has already planted the seeds of Sabbath gratitude within us in the Eucharist, which means thanksgiving. We need only lift up our hearts and give thanks to the Lord our God, who created us, liberated us, and has given us everything we have. Lift up your hearts. And let that be the beginning." Amen.